I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. One of the fine arts of the Washington politician is taking money from the taxpayer and then turning around and giving it back in such a seemingly benevolent and fiscally prudent manner that the taxpayer then rewards the politician with his or her vote for re-election. It was FDR's aide, Harry Hopkins, who coined the formula tax and spend and elect. Now, it used to be thought that Democrats were the spenders, but now it's the Republicans in Washington who are racking up the bills. Republican Congressman John Shattuck says his own party has, quote, discovered the perks of power, and the most powerful of those is spending. And how? The money that's recently been approved for defense and security and Medicare, as well as the hundreds of billions in further discretionary spending and hundreds of billions in tax cuts, is leading America to its largest ever deficit. Some predict that will be $500 billion, perhaps more. The Wall Street firm Goldman Sachs says the U.S. budget is out of control. So the question is, who cares? I mean it, who really cares? Does any politician from any party ever really pay the price for running up a deficit? When it comes to fighting next year's election, will anyone care if the deficit is $500 or $800 or $900 billion? Well, here's our number. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today with one of the few elected people in Washington who says he does care about this, the Republican Representative Jim Nussle of Iowa, is chairman of the House Budget Committee. He's joining us on the phone from Washington. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
Now, you're among the people who's supposed to be trying to keep a handle on spending. What's going wrong?
Well, first of all, I guess a couple of things just from your opening, because it's I think it's important to put it in context. First of all, this is not the largest deficit in history. I mean, that's, you know, you got to start with the basics. This is not the largest deficit in history, particularly when you look at the overall economy.
I'm looking at numbers that go back to 1960, and the highest deficit that I can see is 1992, when it goes up to $290 billion.
Right, but that was at a time when we had about a $6 trillion economy. Now we have a $10 trillion economy. And so you have to look at, you were comparing this to a family with credit cards. If a family's income doubles in that same period of time, they can handle more debt, they can handle more spending. If they have emergencies, they can deal with them in a more fiscally responsible way. And we had exactly that emergency. On September 10th of 2001, we had a surplus. On September 11th, everyone knows what happened, and so we made the very deliberate decision that we needed to protect the country and protect the homeland. We had a war to wage against global terrorism. We had emergencies in both Washington and in New York. And we had an economy that had gotten a gut punch just as it was struggling to get back on its feet. It took a gut punch, which collapsed it yet again. So I think you have to put a little bit of this into context. You can't parachute in today and look at the figures and say, oh, my God, isn't this terrible? You have to look a little bit about what we've been going through as a nation, how big and good we are as far as our economy, and the plan we have to get back. You're exactly right, and John Shattuck and others, I would agree. We spend way too much, and we are spending way too much on things that are, I would say, frivolous, that are not a matter of security or economy. But having said that, I think the rest of it does need to be put into some context.
Okay, well, give me the political context, if you will, because it's your party that's supposed to be the one that watches the growth of government, that calls for accountability in spending, but we both know it's Republicans in charge of the House and the Senate and the White House. So what's changed? Why is it that we're seeing this from the Republican Party?
Well, take out the security spending, take out the defense spending we needed for the war and for Homeland Security, and you see a spending growth in the range of about 4-5%. I still believe that's excessive, but it's certainly not the growth that we're hearing about, you know, as people parachute in and they say, how fast is government growing? Out of context, it is in the 26% range. But what would you have us do? And I'm not asking you, but this is what I ask my constituents. What would you have us not spend money on? You know, supporting the wars that we're waging, defending the country, getting the economy back on track.
Well, I mean, give me a little bit of your own perspective, if you would, Congressman, because you've been there for, I think, 12 years now. And I'm thinking back to the last week when There, everybody was piling on an energy bill, which didn't make it through, but was being marked as one of the biggest sort of collections of regional pork around. The Medicare bill went through at that time with bipartisan support. And I'm curious to know from your perspective whether or not you see that city changing, the way that Washington politicians will say, yeah, we want a little bit of that, we want a little bit of that, and it doesn't really matter if we run up a deficit in order to get that. Have you seen a shift in the way that politicians in Washington manage the nation's money?
Yes, I have. I mean, there's no question that when we got to surplus back in about 1998, when Republicans came in and faced one of the largest deficits in history at that time and got it to a balanced budget, what we found when we got to surplus is that it was, to some extent, fun to spend money, as you were talking, politically expedient to spend money, particularly during good times when there was a lot of money to spend. And there's no question that that practice and that behavior has carried into times that where we needed to be under much more self-control. But having said that, let me just also remind you that Medicare is going bankrupt. And the Medicare bill that we passed last week, or 2 weeks ago now, was within the budget. We budgeted for a modernization of Medicare, including new benefits that were necessary in order to help families across the nation and seniors across the nation modernize a benefit that hadn't really been modernized since about 1980 was the last big change to Medicare. And so, if we've budgeted for it, if you have a plan, and this is true for a family with credit card debt and it's true for a government with debt, if you've got a plan, if you've got a budget, and you do make those kinds of choices within that budget, you can be fiscally responsible at the same time borrowing some money.
But you've still got people who are looking 10, 12, 15 years down the road at who's going to fund Social Security, at who's going to fund Medicare at that time, and also at that time when the tax cuts are coming in, and they're having trouble doing the math and wondering if it isn't someone who sits as the chairman of the House Budget Committee who ought not to be saying, well, you know, it may be 4 or 5% growth, but this is unsustainable.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I'm not apologizing for it. I just want to make sure your listeners have the full context. And they're right to look 15 years down the road and to see what may be the case. But just like a weatherman that's trying to predict the weather a year out, they have absolutely no clue what it's going to look like. You don't know what the economy is going to look like. The same people who are making these dire predictions did not think the economy was going to rebound as a result of the tax reductions that we made this last year. And we just saw the largest quarter of growth, 8.2%. We've seen jobs on the rebound, somewhere near 400,000 as a result of the data that will come out tomorrow. And we have seen a change in the economy for the better as a result of the tax policy that was put in that those same people said would bankrupt the nation. So
what's the message, Congressman, that we look ahead at a $500 billion deficit or whatever
right.
it is going to be for this year, and we ought not to worry. We just need to know that the economy will chug along and wipe it out as it did in the 1990s, that there's no problem?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say two things that we know for sure that we can almost always predict. Number one, a growing economy is the best thing for the United States of America. It's the best for our security. It's the best for our budgets. It's the best for our domestic policy, education, health care, no matter what. If our economy is growing and people are working, that's the best for this country. And number two, the other thing that we know we can control because we can't control anything else is we can control spending. And so that has to be what we control. And non-security spending has been controlled at 4%. I would say this next year it ought to be frozen. It ought to be frozen.
You think that's going to happen in an election year?
Well, we can try.
No, come on now.
Well, you have to understand, too, that a freeze of spending or even a very small increase, let's say 2 or 3%, is built on such a huge increase over the last 4 or 5 years. You take education as an example. People will come on your show. I guarantee you next year when we introduce the budget and complain that we're slashing education and everything else at the same time, forgetting that we had this show saying that we were out of control spending. Well, education over the last 6 years has doubled. The federal government has doubled the amount of dollars going into education, and yet I guarantee, I will bet you any amount of money you want that 6 months from now, somebody will be on your show crying that education somehow has been slashed or cut or gouged as a result of the budget plan that the president put on the table. That's the problem we've got, is that small increases will be complained about on a show like this, and the perception will be in other shows in the future that somehow someone does not keep that priority close to their heart.
All right, quick last political question. Do you think the president is going to pay the price from within his own party or in any quarter for going into an election with a very large deficit?
No, because the opposite is really what needs to be considered. He had no choice. We had no choice, and it was done in a bipartisan way. We drew a deficit as a result of Osama bin Laden, as a result of Saddam Hussein, as a result of the bubble burst in the economy, and the gut punch of 9/11 that hit the economy. If it weren't for those things, we'd still be in a surplus or better. We made the decision that when the roof collapsed, we had to get a new roof as a family, as you were using the analogy, sitting around the kitchen table. We had to make a decision to go into some debt in order to deal with the emergency and at the same time keep our jobs, keep the economy going, and make sure that we were strong into the future.
Congressman, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Congressman Jim Nussle of Iowa, chairman of the House Budget Committee, joining me to continue this program, this conversation, two people who not only know how economies work, but also know Washington politics very well. Stephen Moore is contributing editor of the National Review and president of the Conservative Club for Growth. He was in the late 1980s an economic consultant with the Reagan administration, and sitting in the Christian Science Monitor studio in Washington with him this hour, Alan Murray. Alan's Washington Bureau Chief for the cable financial news channel CNBC, also co-host of Capital Report on that channel, and a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Both of you, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes here until our next break. So just a quick word back from each of you. Stephen, perhaps you can begin here on what we're hearing from Congressman Nussle, that really there's not a problem here.
Well, I have a great deal of respect for Congressman Nussle, but I think that the Republican Party has really lost its fiscal conscience since 1995, when Republicans took over Congress and talked about how we were going to slay the deficit and make government smaller and smarter. And now you've got Republicans defending these very large increases in the budget that you talked about in your opening. So as a Republican, I'm very distressed and embarrassed by this huge spending spree that's going on in Washington.
Alan Murray?
Well, you know, I think one thing you have to say for Congressman Nussle's argument is it's not really a problem that we have a big deficit right now. But he said we have a plan. A plan for getting it down in the future. I can't figure out what that plan is. All the decisions I see seem to be moving in the direction of more spending increases and more tax cuts. And, you know, you can agree with any one of those, but when you put the package together, it doesn't fit. There's a problem.
1-800-423-8255. All right, listeners, does any politician from any party ever really pay a price for running up a deficit? Are you concerned about a number of $500 billion, if that is going to be the deficit for the next fiscal year? Do you think that's going to have political consequences? Would those right-wing Republicans have anywhere else to go if they didn't like what the George Bush government is doing? 1-800-423-8255. For you to join us, I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, a chance to talk about the political implications of deficit considerations, deficit estimates of could go as high as $500 billion for this fiscal year. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Stephen Moore is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Alan Murray, Washington Bureau Chief for the Cable Financial News Channel, CNBC. And let's go back, if we can, gentlemen, to what Congressman Nussle said. He said there's really not going to be a political price to be paid for any of the spending that's taking place in Washington now. He said they had no choice. They had no choice. Alan.
I think he may be right about that. I mean, I don't think the deficit is high on people's lists of concerns, primarily because it's not having a big effect right now. You know, the deficit mattered back in the late 1980s and early 1990s when we were in a period where there was some pretty strong private demand for capital. There was a competition for funds. Interest rates, real interest rates, rose. That caused real pain. And then all of a sudden, people started talking about doing something about the deficit. That was back when Jim Carville, working for Bill Clinton, said that if he could come back in another life, he'd come back as the bond market, because the bond market seemed to have all the power. Everybody was worried about what the bond market was doing to interest rates. But that's not happening right now.
Okay, but who's to say that this deficit, once it's in place, isn't going to cause that competition for capital and isn't going to push interest rates up?
I think it will, but I don't think that competition, that clash, is going to happen between now and the election.
Okay, Stephen, are they going to pay any kind of political price for this?
I sort of wish they would, because I think this is a disgrace, the huge bulge in the budget. And the spending, just to give your listeners some sense of what's happening here, the spending, even on the domestic programs in the budget, is growing at about three times the rate that it was when Bill Clinton was president. And at that time, Republicans used to berate President Clinton for spending so much money. So the budget's out of control. I think one of the problems...
I'm lost here, Stephen. I'm missing something, because the congressman was saying, no, we're at 4 to 5%. We're exactly where we want to be. And you're saying that the discretionary spending is way, way above that. Is this...
Yeah, it's a lot higher than some of the numbers that he was suggesting. One of the things that's going on now is that Republicans are redefining a lot of the budget as homeland security, things that we've always spent money on. And so I think there's a little bit of financial chicanery going on with respect to the way they're looking at the numbers. But the main thing is, if you just look at, take out defense spending and you look at everything else, and the budget's been growing about 8% per year at a time, by the way, when we've had almost no inflation. But I just wanted to make a point about this, the political consequences of the deficit. As I see it, one of the real problems that we have right now in Washington is that there's no one that I can see in either party who is standing up for fiscal conservatism. I remember in the early 1990s, we had two real heroes, people I know that my friend Alan Murray remembers, Tim Penny and John Kasich. And in fact, they got together in the early 1990s and put a package together to try to do something about the deficit. And this was, I think, the real the first assault against the deficit. And they were real heroes. They talked about making some painful spending cuts, but getting the budget under control. And there's nobody in either party that's fulfilled that role.
We also had Ross Perot out there a public issue.
Right. Maybe that's what we need in 2004.
That's right. There is no Ross Perot on the current political scene.
Because the problem for the Democrats, as I see it, is I really wish the Democrats had a sort of genuine new Democrat in the field who was railing against some of these spending policies. But unfortunately, if you listen to Howard Dean and Kerry and others, they're railing against the tax cut and saying, we'll raise taxes, but they don't seem to be real deficit hawks themselves. And I think Alan is right. Maybe what we need is a new H. Ross Perot to emerge and make this an issue again.
But Alan, doing something about the tax cuts would certainly help balance things, at least in the short term, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I totally agree with Stephen on that. I mean, if you look at what Howard Dean is saying, he's repealing all of the Bush tax cuts. That would obviously have a pretty big dent on the deficit, but it would leave you with heading into the future with a much bigger federal government. I mean, that's the problem here. We have to make decisions about how much government we think is appropriate for the country. That's not what's happening right now. What's happening right now is the president favors tax cuts. Great. Everybody likes to have their taxes cut. The president favors spending increases. Great. Everybody likes to have spending increases, but it doesn't add up. And until you make some sort of fundamental decisions about the level of government that we think is appropriate for this society, then the other stuff is just it just doesn't work. It doesn't make sense.
And I guess that's where we're going to be this hour, Stephen, because if it doesn't add up, and even if there were a Democrat candidate who was making that point over and over again, I don't know whether or not it would stick.
Well, maybe not. I mean, a part of the problem with railing against budget deficits is that I always like to make the case that people have become sort of anesthetized to these arguments against big deficits, because after all, in the 1980s, people said, be these big deficits are going to lead to financial ruin for the country. And we had big deficits, and the economy did well for the next 15 years. And even now, to make the case that big deficits lead to higher interest rates, it's a hard argument to make, because we have, you know, the roughly the largest deficits ever, and yet we have the lowest interest rates ever. So it makes it hard to make that case about crowding out. The reason I oppose these budget deficits is I think they're sort of a fiscal cop-out for the politicians. It allows them to spend a dollar and only raise 80 cents of taxes, so it makes it too easy for them to spend.
1-800-423-8255. Let's see what our listeners are thinking this hour. To Lowell, Massachusetts. Peter, you're with us. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Fine.
Okay, this is my point. I think the situation is this. It's a culture issue, and it's an attitude issue. Everybody else in the whole country right now lives on credit. The bigger your credit is, guess what? The more you can say, I'm wealthy. The wealth is not counted in how much dollars you have. It's counted on how big your mortgage is, how big you're paying to GM for your truck outside. And when you go anywhere else to eat, they actually offer you an incentive to use your credit card as opposed to cash. So it's not going to be a big issue at all, because everybody else is living on credit. Nobody owns anything. Everybody is on credit, and that's the point that we're missing.
I think you've touched a nerve with both Stephen and Alan here.
As long as we are all living on credit, guess what? The politicians are going to do the same thing. The bigger the deficit of the country is, everybody else feels, the bigger we are than anybody else. But at the end of the day, you don't own anything.
Steve,
and that's what the point is.
Stephen, Alan, let me hear from you.
Well, I think he's got a point. You know, you asked the question, does the president pay a political price for big deficits? I think it's quite the opposite. In fact, the president gets a big political benefit from this as a political strategy. I think what he's doing is going to work to his benefit because, you know, the tax cuts are very popular with a substantial part of the electorate. I don't think Howard Dean or Dick Gephardt are going to make much headway in a general election by saying we want to raise taxes on every American. I don't think that works as a political matter. And at the same time, the spending is popular as well. You know, providing free prescription drugs to senior citizens sounds great. Well, you know, who doesn't want to give free prescription drugs to senior citizens? Now, they're not going to be free because they at least held down the size of that bill. So I think as a political matter, what the caller is saying is probably right. It's
but
just at some point there will be consequences. Exactly.
Let's get to that. Stephen, as I said a couple of minutes ago, there are no fiscally conservative Republicans who are going to say, I'm so damn angry with the president that I'm going to vote for Dennis Kucinich, you know? I mean, what else? Where else are they going to go?
Well, I think that's exactly the kind of political calculation that Karl Rove and George Bush have made, is that, you know, it is true that President Bush gave us this tax cut. It's something that I'm strongly in favor of. I think it's helped the economy, and I think that's really critical to getting the first step to getting the deficit under control. But the point about a budget is about making choices. And what frustrates me with President Bush, and I'm a supporter of President Bush's, is that he doesn't seem to want to make any choices. He says we can have the tax cut, we can have the war in Iraq, we can have all the spending on Homeland Security, we can have more on education, more on farm programs, more on Medicare prescription drugs. And no, that's not the way a budget works. You have to, if you're going to have more guns, you have to have less butter. At least that's the way we've done it for 100 years.
1-800-423-8255. Peter, thanks for that call. Next to Chatham County, North Carolina. Nick, you're with us. Go ahead.
Yes, this situation reminds me a lot of what happened with, and these are old historical precedents, what happened with the Spanish Empire in the 16th century and the Ancien regime in France, where the government pursues a taxation policy which exempts political and economic elites from taxation, like the dividend tax cut in this country, and the exemption of the where the nobles in France were exempted from taxations because they supposedly gave more to the government through their military service, and the Spanish landowners who owned sheep were exempted from taxation. And what this led to was the government pursuing adventurous policies which benefited the elite, and the elite's not paying the taxation on it. And this eventually led to the bankruptcy of the Spanish government and its decline as a both a European and a world power, and eventually to the French Revolution in France. And this situation, while it may not be leading to that right now, seems to be bearing
Are you saying that this is in a larger context, Nick, than the Bush administration in 2003? Are you saying that basically the way that Washington spends money that it doesn't have is something that goes back to other administrations?
Well, I think this has been an ongoing process over the years. Okay. And I think that it may be a long range thing, but the Bush administration seems to be pursuing a policy which over and over exempts the elites from taxation, and yet pursues policies which are very expensive for their benefit. It increases the power, both economic and political, of these elites. I mean, if you're a Republican who's being exempted from dividend taxation, I mean, sure, give thousands of dollars to the Bush people, because you're getting more than your investment back. In fact, for them, investing in the Republican Party is the best investment they can make right now.
Stephen, this is the same thing that I was reading in a recent column by E.J. Dionne, when he was just saying that the Bush plan is to push as much public money towards its friends and allies in the form of tax cuts, with the expectation that enough of it will come back so they will guarantee themselves re-election. Is Nick right with this one?
Well, I don't think he is. I mean, I don't think that it's true. In fact, the facts show just the opposite, that in fact that the rich and the elite are not getting away without paying taxes. In fact, the top 1% pay about 35% of the income taxes. Now, I was a strong supporter of the dividend tax cut and the capital gains cut, because those are double and triple taxations on the same source of income. And so I believe that one of the reasons the stock market has done so well over the last 6 months is because we did cut the capital gains and dividend tax. I'd like to cut those taxes down to zero. But on the other hand, I think the other part of his point is probably true, that the Republicans like to spend money, on corporate welfare and programs like that. For example, with this Medicare bill that we just passed, I had argued, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page had argued, that if we want to provide a drug benefit to seniors that are in poverty that can't afford their own drugs, we could have done that at a fraction of the cost of this bill. But the bill we just passed 2 weeks ago is going to subsidize the drugs for people like H. Ross Perot.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Alan, what about the argument that what's working for the Bush administration in this one is that the bills won't ever have to be paid by the people who are supposed to be taxpayers now, but they're all going to come due for the kids who are in primary school right now. Is that true? Is it that simple?
Well, that may be oversimplifying it a little bit, but yeah, sure, that's basically true. That's when the bills come due. I mean, look, there are two pieces to this. One is, when you have a weak economy, as we have had for the last couple of years, it's a good idea to run a deficit. And I don't really have any problem with the way fiscal policy has been run up to this point. But the flip side of that is that then when the economy is starting to recover, then you've got to sort of tighten the screws and make sure you're paying for what you're spending, or else you will be leaving a large bill for future generations. And the big problem we have is, as Stephen just alluded to, is that when the baby boomers retire, starting in the next decade, you're going to have these huge costs of Social Security and Medicare, now expanded with the prescription drug benefit for everybody, that are going to be paid by the working people. They're going to be paid by the people who are still working at that time. And I think that is a problem.
One of the things that Congressman Nussel said, that Alan's comment reminded me, he said, well, we are seeing that we've got this multi-trillion-dollar deficit in the Medicare program. But then this Congress turns around and then passes a bill that just yesterday the Congressional Budget Office says will add $2 trillion to the unfunded liability of a program that's already $12 trillion in debt. That's what I find fiscally unconscionable.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Norfolk, Virginia now. Art's with us. Hi, Art. Go ahead.
Hi. Just a quick comment concerning the fact that I do plan to vote this issue, in the upcoming election for the 2004 cycle. One, because in 3 to 5 years, these bills will become due in small measure. But in the larger sense, I agree with your first caller that says that this is a culture, whereas we're delaying the impact, but the impact is going to be even greater on the back end.
Have you found a party or a candidate that's talking about this, Art?
No, I sure haven't. Not a national candidate that's trumpeting the issue or leading the charge to say, let's do it. And really, I would have expected the Republican Party. I would guess McCain from Arizona is about as close as I've seen, who's been raising the flag on the issue.
It's going to happen, just as it did in the late 1980s. It's going to happen again. This will become a problem. It will have some effect on interest rates. People will start to focus on it again. Someone will rise up and be the new H. Ross Perot to make a fuss about it, and then we'll probably have to figure out a way to deal with it then. But I don't see any sign that it's going to happen between now and the election.
You see, in the 1990s, people look back to the deficit there and they think, okay, well, we jumped off the bridge, but the tide was in, the fall was short, and we were just fine. And so we can jump off the bridge again.
Yeah, but see, what that ignores is the fact that even starting with Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, pushed through a big package of tax cuts, increased defense spending. But then when confronted with figures showing that he didn't have a sustainable long-term plan, he backed a bill in 1982 that I imagine Stephen didn't like very much, but that increased taxes a little bit to make up for the difference. He coordinated an effort in 1983 that cut Social Security benefits. Can you imagine anybody doing that right now? Cut Social Security benefits and raise payroll taxes to get Social Security more in line. And then we had a series of efforts in the late 80s and the early 90s to deal with the deficit problem. What concerns me right now is I don't see that happening. I don't hear anything out of the White House that suggests a recognition that that even needs to happen, in fact, or from Congress, for that matter, any recognition that something like that needs to be put on the table.
All right. Art, thanks for that call. Connection listeners, are you looking for a candidate who's talking about these issues, or do these issues really matter? Is this just something that comes up and goes away and we can get on with our daily affairs? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Stephen Moore, contributing editor to the National Review, and Alan Murray. He writes a weekly column for the political section of the Wall Street Journal. He's also Washington Bureau Chief for CNBC. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We began the program by listening to Congressman Jim Nussle talk about the fact that spending in Washington is really something that the politicians have had to do, particularly since 9/11, taking care of issues like homeland security, the war in Afghanistan, and the war in Iraq. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. Next to Cary, North Carolina. David's joining us. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I just have to respond to your opening guest, the Republican from Iowa. My brother died at the World Trade Center on September 11th, and I just have to tell you how furious I am with the Republican Party for blaming September 11th for the federal deficit. 9/11 did not cause the federal deficit. What caused the deficit is massive tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires. And, you know, this is something that is just really driving me up the wall when I hear people talk about the post-9/11 climate and using that as basically, as far as the Republicans are concerned, as an excuse for gutting the federal budget and basically privatizing Social Security and dismantling the federal government.
There is some truth to what they say, David, isn't there? That they that an entire new government, Department of Homeland Security, was set up, and tens of thousands of American soldiers went overseas to Afghanistan, and I mean, Iraq is a different issue.
Well, I don't really agree that the war in Iraq is making us safer. I actually believe that the war in Iraq is making us less safe. And frankly, if you want to make America more productive and safer, since September 11th, why don't you give jobs to people instead of having 2.5 million people lose their jobs? That's how you make people safe, by having a strong economy, not by giving tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires. You know, I have a one-year-old daughter crawling around my living room floor right now, and when we give these tax breaks, what we're doing is raising her taxes. And basically, we are just delaying the day of reckoning. And this is something that I said drives me crazy about politicians, mostly Republicans, because they tend to lie more than Democrats. But frankly, it's Republicans and Democrats. When we talk about cutting taxes, what we're really doing is raising taxes on our children. And it just amazes me that we don't care about our children more.
Stephen Moore, this linking together of patriotism and spending, this is something that politically can be very sensitive in the way that either a politician chooses to talk about it or the way that someone like David hears it.
Yeah, I think I agree with part of what David was saying and strongly disagree with another part. The part that I agree with is that he's right that to some extent Republicans and Democrats, but mostly Republicans, have basically wrapped all of their favorite spending programs around the flag in the last 2 years and said, we need to do this for national security and for Homeland Security reasons. And so even if you look at the Homeland Security bill, it is packed with pork barrel spending on things like, shark research and the Cowgirl Hall of Fame and grasshopper eradication programs. I don't think too many people are worried about being invaded by grasshoppers.
There's a Hooters restaurant in there, too, somewhere. But we
right. There's all of this, spending. And so every program that comes up, we need it for national security. But let me just say one thing about the tax cut, because I'm a strong supporter of the president's tax cut. And in fact, was over at the White House a number of times helping put it together. And we made essentially two calculations with the tax cut. The first was that if we did this reduction in capital gains tax and dividend and income tax cuts, that it would help stimulate the stock market and stimulate the economy. And here I will defend this to the hilt. I think that tax cut is working. The economy is picking up, just as the congressman said. The stock market has been up. So it is creating jobs. But the second calculation we made that was that by taking this revenue away from the politicians, that it would stop them from spending.
And
that hasn't worked at all. So part of it has worked and part of it hasn't.
Alan.
Well, I look. If you ask the question, what causes the deficits, the answer is all of the above. It was caused certainly by the tax cuts. It is caused by a slowing economy. It is caused by the cost of the war. It is caused by all these ridiculous things, some not so ridiculous, some ridiculous, that have been packaged together as homeland defense. It's caused by an unwillingness of Congress or the White House to sort of control spending in other areas. You put it all together and you end up with big deficits. It gets back to what Stephen was saying. You got to make some choices. If you want to have tax cuts, fine, but then you can't have everything else. And if you say, well, we have to spend on the war in Iraq and we have to build up our defense and we have to build up our homeland defense, then maybe you better go back and take a second look at whether the tax cut went too far. But one way or another, moving into the future, you got to start making the two lines, the revenue line and the spending line, start moving together. And right now they're not.
All right, David, thanks for the call. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina. Michael, you're up. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I called concerning the subject of pork barrel, since it's only pork barrel as long as you're not getting a slice of the bacon. And I was wondering if your guests could give their personal definition of pork barrel and some less obscure examples rather than the cricket program that would cause some emotional stirs, such as, maybe a social program for, sick kids or something, but it's still pork barrel. And I was wondering if they could give some examples of that.
I can give you what I think is a pretty accepted definition here in Washington. Pork barrel projects are things that are put into these spending bills by a single member of Congress to benefit some interest in their district or in their state. They don't go through any sort of vetting. They don't come. They're not recommended by government agencies. They're not the subject of hearings. They are put in, stuck into the bill in the fine print to narrowly benefit their own constituents.
And it's not a measure of the worthiness of the program. I mean, if it's the extension on a library in somebody's town, it can still be pork barrel if it's put in the way that you're describing it, Alan?
They might be good. They might be bad. There's been no process to evaluate them. They've just been stuck in as favors, goodies to benefit. And what's happening more and more is the only goodies that get in there are for the members of Congress who support the bills. So you're seeing, you're now seeing more and more of it. It's becoming more of a political tool. The Republicans who support major pieces of legislation, or Democrats who go over and support major pieces of legislation, are the ones who are getting the pork. It's especially
quasi-embezzlement, then, right?
Well, it's you know, some people will refer to it as kind of the grease that skids legislation, you know, lets legislation move smoothly through the process. But some of it is bribery. Some of it's to get votes, you know, say, well, if you'll vote with us on this bill, we'll give you that funding for that Please Touch Museum in Philadelphia you care about, or for your grasshopper eradication program.
And Michael, back to you. I mean, if your own congressman comes back at election time and says, I didn't really do anything for Rod. I didn't bring you anything like a Boys and Girls Club or this new project, because I kind of thought that was fiscally irresponsible to be putting my hand into the bacon pan along with the others. Isn't there a risk that that person won't get reelected?
Well, that's the sad part about it. I'm afraid that it is so rampant because it does work, but that doesn't make it right.
Michael, thanks for your call.
You betcha.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Stephen Moore, has it always been thus? We talked earlier in the program, or I did rather, with Congressman Nussel about whether or not we're watching some kind of shift or change in Washington where, you know, nobody's willing to stand up and say that the emperor has no clothes or the emperor has too many clothes. Do you see it as a shift?
I do. I think what's going on, and the reason we're seeing the reemergence of these large deficits, going back to that point I made earlier, is that in the 1970s, we had, you know, $50 to $100 billion deficits. And people said, this is the end of the world. And Ronald Reagan won the election partly by saying, you know, I'm going to get rid of these deficits. And then in the 1980s, the deficit skyrocketed to $200 billion. And people said, this is the end of the world, and the economy went on its merry way. And now we're experimenting with deficits that are in a new realm that we've never seen before. And my question is, you know, how far do you skate out on this ice, you know, before it gets so thin that you fall into the water and drown? And I think that's the risk that both Alan and I see.
But you never know till you fall through, do you?
That's true. But you never want to go out that far to test the water or the ice. The other point I think Ellen and I would both agree on is that the real problem with these deficits is that we should now be in an era right before the baby boomers retiring, where we're squirreling away money to prepare for this fiscal hit that we're going to take with these old age programs when the baby boomers start retiring. After all, there are something like 75 million of us, and we tend to get what we want politically over the last 40 years. And so that's a big worry, too,
exactly.
Is are we going to see trillion-dollar deficits in 5 years, and you're going to have us back on the show, and we're going to say, can we afford these deficits?
Exactly. I mean, I came to Washington 25 years ago. I can't ever remember a period when there was as little fiscal discipline as there seems to be right now. Now, there may be good reasons for that. I think Stephen's right. Some of it started when we had surpluses. Then you had 9/11, and people said, well, we can't get – this is not a time to be cheap. You know, this is not a time to hold back. Then we had the war and the extraordinary expenses on the war, but it seems to just be continuing, and there doesn't seem to be any real break on it, and it's happening at the worst possible time because of the retirement of the baby boomers.
So if there is this kind of culture change in Washington, where really the politician's primary concern is what he or she can bring back for his or her district, and it's all so short term, and it's payback from one party to another based on an election, then it really does seem that there has to be some kind of cataclysmic economic event to shake both parties out of this sense that there's no penalty for this kind of behavior.
That's probably true. And you know, history shows that, you know, major changes in public policy do happen during periods of crisis. Hopefully that crisis won't happen. You know, I do think I'm a supply sider. I do think that the one silver lining here, and I don't want to sound we've been sort of apocalyptic. I do think if the president's economic program works and we do get back on a healthy economic growth pace for the next 3 to 5 to 7 years, you are going to see an increase in revenues, and we will be able to afford some of the spending. So it is true that economic growth is as a precondition to getting the budget under control, and we've got to keep our fingers crossed that this economy performs as President Bush has hoped it will.
And Alan, I'm just wondering whether or not you think that you know, a Ross Perot or a John McCain or a Chuck Hale or anybody, you know, speaking out in favor of some kind of fiscal discipline is ever going to be listened to, or whether or not there has to be, you know, something more dramatic to get the attention of people there.
I think you sort of have to have both. You have to have something going on that makes people feel the pain of deficits, and you have to have an effective spokesman. Right now, I don't think you really have either one of them out there. Deficits don't matter right now. In fact, they're a good thing right now, not a bad thing. One of the reasons the economy is picking up so strongly is because we've had this combination of deep tax cuts and spending increases. And so, you know, for the moment, it's not something that people are going to get upset about. But when they realize that this is not a temporary thing, that all the trend lines are going to keep going in the same direction, then I think, and when it starts to have an effect on interest rates, possibly on international relations, the dollar, then you could see, and if you get an effective spokesman, then you could see a change.
Now, Alan was saying a couple of minutes ago, Stephen, that Reagan had the sort of political will to change his own policy, to say, okay, well, maybe we do need to raise taxes. Maybe we do need to impose a certain amount of fiscal discipline on ourselves. Can you see this happening from within the Bush administration that we know now?
Well, I always say what Reagan did in 1982 was the biggest mistake he made in his presidency, because I think it took the heat off the spending cuts. But, you know, I do think that sometime in the next couple of years, there is going to be a getting together of these folks to say, look, we can't stay on this path. We have to do something about getting spending under control. As I said earlier, you're going to need some people to step up to the plate like John Kasich and Tim Penny did 10 years ago. And I don't know who those will be. Maybe a John McCain.
Stephen, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Stephen Moore, president of the Conservative Club for Growth and a contributor to National Review. Alan Murray, nice to have you back.
Great to be with you.
Alan is Washington Bureau Chief for CNBC and a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Earlier in the program, we talked with Republican Congressman Jim Nussle, chairman of the House Budget Committee. Connection listeners, we invite you to our website. We are at www.theconnection.org, where you can continue this conversation in our forum pages. Our program is produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Jennifer Giles and Sarah Ligon. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.